call your attention to Mr. Bond's impeccable tailoring from London's Savile Row. The shirt is a hand-tailored Indian madras. Also the cravat, hand-woven of Javanese batik. An essential feature of Mr. Bond's wardrobe is the pistol in his right hand. It is a Walther PPK, 7.65 mil. It takes a Brausch silencer with very little reduction in muzzle velocity. It has a delivery like a brick through a plate glass window. His secret agent code number is 007.
If you carry a 00 number, it means you're licensed to kill, not get killed.
Welcome to another edition of the History Through Film podcast. That's awful.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I'm your host, Curtis Allen. That was awful. Obviously, we're doing Bond, James Bond. Yeah, it's going to get really bad in here. So my guest, again, is Alex Winkler. Alex, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Mr. Allen.
There you go. Okay. Yeah, you're going to have to deal with our horrible Sean Connery impersonations, but that is today's podcast. We are focusing on Sean Connery, Bond, James Bond, the Sean Connery years. And I just want to mention the little sound clip that I put at the beginning of the podcast, which I normally do. That is an original Dr. No trailer that I dug up. And what's interesting about it, I was talking to Alex before we started recording, is it's almost as if they were introducing James Bond to American audiences. Not that I don't think there was much introduction needed, but perhaps they were just bringing people up to speed. So if you were to Google that on YouTube, please do. Check it out. It's pretty interesting. It just goes into a little bit of the exotic locations with Dr. No and some of the other things that James Bond is obviously known for. So we are here to do James Bond, a little bit of history through film. I have used a couple of James Bond films in my class when I talk about 1950s, Cold War, espionage, and of course the 60s, because the novels, which Alex is going to talk about a little bit more here, were made in the 50s. But yeah, so let's cover James Bond films, the Connery years. I think we've got six of them total, or seven. Is it six or seven? We'll figure it out, I guess.
We'll find out on the
way.
We'll
find out as we get through them. So, Alex, first of all, what is your... you are quite the fan of James Bond. Why? What intrigues you about him?
You know, I was kind of a late bloomer in the Bond years. I'd only caught bits and pieces of a few Bond films growing up. The most experience I actually had with Bond as a kid was playing... and if any of you guys are listening to this, you'll feel the nostalgia with me, was the GoldenEye game for the Nintendo 64. I had a neighbor who owned that, and in the gaming community, GoldenEye for the 64 was one of the first real first-person shooters that kind of modernized the way things were done. And I remember playing that with friends in my neighborhood. But that was really the only Bond experience I had. And then I went off to college. My first year of college, I saw Skyfall. I had some friends that wanted to go see Skyfall. So we went and saw Skyfall. And I was like, well, this was a good one. So I went back and I started watching basically in order, Connery all the way up to Craig. And just kind of fell in love with them. My wife and I really enjoy the series. It was kind of a thing that we did when we first started dating, was one of our movie series that we kind of got into at the same time. So that's my first real interactions with the franchise.
Yeah, I I'll say it again. I'm a little older than you, but my first experience has got to be Roger Moore, because being a kid of the 70s, that was my James Bond. But again, as my interest grew in those films, I too had gone back and watched the Sean Connery ones, and then was ushered into the Timothy Dalton era after that, and of course, Pierce Brosnan, and then, you know, the newer ones with Daniel Craig, which everyone tends to agree are really
phenomenal,
good, really yeah. good. So it was nice to see James Bond kind of get rebooted with Casino Royale. But we are obviously focusing on the Sean Connery years, like I mentioned. So, but let's take a step back and talk a little bit about Ian Fleming and what do we know about him?
Well, it's important that we talk about Fleming. He is the author of the James Bond books. He's the creator of James Bond. But before we can talk about Bond, I feel like we have to talk about Fleming and who he was and kind of where he came up with the character and his influences, because Fleming itself himself is an extremely interesting person, a very intriguing history. He's growing up. His father was killed in World War I, so there's some obviously military history in his family right away. You know, his mother places a burden on his mother raising him. He's athletic. He's smart, but doesn't do extremely well in school growing up. He's a bit of a bad boy. He's a bit of a rebel. Kind of has a reputation. He was going to Eton and left Eton, actually went to Sandhurst Military College, and did not do well there. The structure and the rules did not bode well for a young Ian Fleming. His temperament did not match up with military school, and he left. He went and studied language for a year. He actually got sent off to Austria. And in Austria, the teacher or the institute that he was in was run by a former member of MI6. And his wife was a writer.
Okay.
So two things that really got Fleming into the MI6, the intelligence realm, and his ability to write.
To write, yes.
And he wrote a little bit in school. While he was studying as well. Then he went on to Munich in Geneva, and he studied German and French. And this, of course, is in the 1930s, and that knowledge of German and French will come into play in just a few years and will become extremely important.
Yes.
He actually goes to work as a reporter after that. He's reporting for newspapers. He has some influence. He knows some people. His brother is actually becoming a famous writer in England, and he becomes a naval intelligence officer.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And he has enough sway and influence that he becomes the assistant to the director of naval intelligence, a guy named John Godfrey, Rear Admiral John Godfrey, who would later become the inspiration for M.
M, yes, okay.
So the character M in the Bond film most likely is based off of Rear Admiral John Godfrey, who
Chief of British Intelligence.
Who was the director of naval intelligence, and then that will obviously turn into Chief of British Intelligence. By the way, M is, I find, a fascinating character. My personal favorite's probably Judi Dench. I think she was incredible
yes.
in that role. Both with Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig.
Yes, definitely.
But so Fleming works with the intelligence sections of the British Armed Forces. And then World War II happens. And obviously the intelligence game kicks up into high gear. Fleming is well known. And he starts basically scheming. His job is to help come up with missions, to help come up with ways to gather intel, and some of his plans actually become fairly famous. There is an invasion, intended invasion from Italy to North Africa called Operation Mincemeat. And the plan behind Mincemeat, although this wasn't credited to him, but Fleming actually came up with the idea before it was put into practice, was planting misleading papers on a corpse that they then tossed over a boat and floated it into German-held territory or Italian-held territory, and the papers were full of false information.
Interesting.
And so Fleming actually had the previous idea for that. And he was talking about how it's not easy to get it's easy to get a corpse. It just has to be a fresh one.
Yes.
And so they got one from the morgue and shipped it off. Here's where things get really interesting, though. Fleming also worked with a United States colonel. His nickname, Wild Bill. He's Colonel Wild Bill Donovan.
Wild Bill.
And that was FDR's special representative to London for intelligence.
Okay.
And what happens is Fleming goes to the United States in 1941. And Fleming actually assists in writing a blueprint for a department called the Office of the Coordinator of Information, which turns into the OSS. And the OSS obviously stands for the Office of Strategic Services, which becomes the CIA. And again, I have to drop an old video game reference in here. The original Medal of Honor video game that was where I was introduced to the OSS, because you work for the OSS in that game back, you know, for the PlayStation 1 back in the 90s. So Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond, actually helped design the CIA.
Wow.
So Fleming obviously has a huge spy intelligence background. And he actually gets put in charge of an operation called Operation Goldeneye. Should sound familiar.
Yes.
So Goldeneye was the plan. He had to come up with how they were going to maintain an intelligence framework, how they were going to keep up their intelligence in Spain had Spain been taken over by the Germans. As the war goes on, in 1942, Fleming actually forms his own task force of commandos. And these commandos are designed to go behind enemy lines or near the front of advance and to get intelligence, find intelligence from the Germans. It was later known as the T-Force. Fleming didn't fight alongside them, but it was his idea. He was the commander. He was the leader of that. So World War II ends. Fleming leaves, becomes the foreign manager for the Kimsley newspaper group. And in his time off, he travels to Jamaica. Jamaica, the tropics, a heavily influenced location in the Bond universe.
Yep.
And his home, his household in Jamaica is known as Goldeneye.
Goldeneye, yep.
Which is actually a resort you can go to today.
Oh, really?
You can stay in the Goldeneye Resort.
Yes.
Yeah. So during World War II, Fleming said, I want to write a spy novel. He told his friends, I want to write a spy novel. And he married Anne Charteris, who he was having an affair with at the time. Fleming was a womanizer, did not always take the vows of matrimony seriously.
Well, that sounds familiar. James Bond.
And he sits down in Jamaica at Goldeneye Resort on his typewriter and begins to write the book known as Casino Royale.
Yes.
The first Bond book written. Fleming writes it based on his own experiences. The thing is, though, a lot of Fleming's experiences were classified. So we never actually get a full picture of what Fleming may have done in the war. So, you know, who knows some of the things that happened in the Bond books and in the Bond films, how much that came from maybe Fleming leaking classified information or talking about things without actually talking about them. Casino Royale, some inspiration behind that. A World War II trip to neutral Portugal, and they're in a casino. And Fleming, ever the socialite, the nightlife person, proposed an idea while gambling at the casino that he said, man, would it not have been fun if we would have played against the Germans here? And that kind of was the inspiration for Casino Royale. He comes up with the name James Bond. And you know how he comes up with the name of James Bond?
I have heard this story before. I think, wasn't it from a bird watcher?
An ornithologist.
Yes, named, ornithologist.
Yep. Named, and Fleming is an avid bird watcher in Jamaica. So he picks up what he considered his go-to guide for bird watching, and it was by an ornithologist named James Bond. And he wanted his character to have a plain, boring-sounding name. And Fleming said, James Bond is about the most boring, basic name I can come up with.
I saw that, too. That was in my notes. It says, quote, when I wrote the first one in 1953, I wanted Bond to be an extremely dull, uninteresting man to whom things happened. I wanted him to be a blunt instrument. When I was casting around for a name for my protagonist, I thought, by God, James Bond is one of the dullest names I ever heard. So apparently that's a quote from him. Yes.
And so he writes Casino Royale, not met right away with much favor. What actually pushes it through, Fleming's brother Peter is an accomplished writer, And through Peter's connections, Casino Royale gets published, and the rest is history.
Yes.
They take off. JFK actually lists Fleming as one of his favorite authors. Uh-huh. Loved the novel From Russia with Love. And eventually, as we see so many times, the star of a book gets a movie franchise.
Yes. Well, and speaking of JFK, I also noted that From Russia with Love was the last film he ever saw on June 20th, I believe, before he heads down to Dallas. Mm. So they actually screened it in the White House. Yeah, it was November 20th, 1963, before heading to Dallas, JFK, because it was on like his top 10 list of books, favorite books, and it was From Russia with Love of that year, and then of course before he died. So what's interesting is that the books are kind of out of order, you know,
the films don't match up directly with the books.
So I've, you know, as the books that I have, Casino Royale, and then a year later was Live and Let Die, and then after that was Moonraker, which of course has nothing to do with the Moonraker that is going to be Roger Moore's. That was due to the success of Star Wars. So they kind of changed that plot of that. Diamonds Are Forever, From Russia With Love, Dr. No, Goldfinger, For Your Eyes Only, Thunderball, The Spy Who Loved Me, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, You Only Live Twice, The Man with the Golden Gun. And then 1966, he rounds it off with Octopussy and The Living Daylights.
Mm-hmm. Which were published posthumously.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, the movies go, you know, way out of order.
But you forgot one book written in there.
What's that?
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Ian Fleming, James, the creator of James Bond, writes the classic children's novel, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. The screenplay was adapted by Roald Dahl, who also worked on some Bond screenplays as well.
Yeah. Yes. So that brings us, I guess, into the films themselves. And, you know, the Dr. No was chosen, I believe, to be the first film. I think just because the story seemed a little bit more filmable at the time. It was the exotic location of Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring in Terrence Young, the director, and what I saw from watching one of the behind-the-scenes short videos was really Sean Connery's James Bond had a lot to do with the tailoring that Terrence Young did. I guess he was a renowned director at the time, a kind of an up-and-coming, somebody who had a lot of style in his films. And it was, you know, even Sean Connery in an interview gave credit for Terrence Young really molding James Bond into how we know him today.
Terrence Young and Connery work on creating the appropriate style for James Bond.
You have to remember that Sean was a pretty rough diamond at that time, and Terrence taught him everything he knew.
I think he really sort of coached Sean how to be James Bond. He had a maximum amount of style.
He had an enormous influence on creating James Bond in the person of Sean.
This real style and the movement of the piece was Terrence Young stamped all over it.
If you asked what were the three ingredients for Dr. No for James Bond, it was Sean Connery, Sean Connery, and Sean Connery.
So that was something I wasn't really aware of, because I guess the books kind of differ from the films as far as James Bond's style.
You know, slightly. Bond in the books is, like Fleming said, a very blunt object used to complete the job. He's cold at times. You know, there's slight humor in the Bond books, but he is a cold, calculated instrument of intelligence for the British government. That's what he's supposed to do. That's what he's designed to be. Connery probably cleans up the role a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't quite as rough. But you know, he still does a pretty good job reflecting the Connery from the books. You know, he does, or the Bond from the books. Connery does. He still has a little bit of humor. He is able to do the action sequences and still do the gritty parts. Probably not as good as the grit from Daniel Craig,
right.
Who's probably the most hard-nosed Bond we've seen out of all of them. But Connery wasn't the first choice. To be Bond.
Yeah.
Ian Fleming wanted his friend David Niven to be Sean Connery.
I could see that, but it'd certainly be a different James Bond, that's for sure.
Would he be a mustachioed James Bond?
Mustachio, yeah, I don't know. Because you're right, you'd have that thin, paper-thin mustache, pencil-thin, I should say, David Niven kind of became his trademark as well. Well, and I also read where, Bond's first appearance was back in 1954 on television.
That's right.
Where they got CBS got the rights to an hour or to Casino Royale.
Mm-hmm.
It was an hour long special. Didn't really do that well. I mean, something else that's interesting is Roger Moore. I don't know if you knew this, but Roger Moore actually portrayed James Bond in a British comedy sketch
series. That's right, yeah.
It was in 1964. It was a sketch done on When a Spy Takes a Vacation. You can find it on YouTube. It's actually kind of funny because the whole shtick is that he's relaxing by the pool and he's on a date and he is trying to enjoy a vacation where things start happening to him. And as we get into Dr. No, there are some interesting behind-the-scenes information that I dug up as well. And one thing that I think I may have mentioned to you is the gun barrel sequence.
Yeah.
That was shot with a stuntman known as Bob Simmons. And what caused Sean Connery to finally take over that role, in other words, what we're saying is when you see the gun barrel sequence and James Bond walks out and he kind of turns and shoots. That's not Sean Connery. It wasn't Sean Connery until Thunderball, because they had to reshoot it because aspect ratios had changed in movie theater screens. So the gun barrel sequence that is known in James Bond films. If you look closely, you can tell it doesn't quite look like Sean Connery. Looks like somebody a little different. And then, of course, that's kicked off by the James Bond theme composed by John Barry and written by Monty Norman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should probably pause for 1 second and think about all those classic things that Dr. No introduced us to,
yes,
like the James Bond theme, which is played a whole lot more in the Connery ones. You hear it multiple times in the film, whereas you get into the newer ones today and it's not nearly as prevalent. It's still in it,
right,
but it seems like every 20 minutes in a Sean Connery one, you heard the theme. But you do have the gun barrel sequence. That's kind of iconic, obviously. You get introduced to just kind of the suaveness of James Bond, because the first line that he speaks in Dr. No is...
I admire your courage, Miss...
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr...
Bond. James Bond.
Bond.
James Bond. He's sitting around the casino table. I forget what they're playing exactly. Maybe Baccarat or something like that. Yeah, you're right. And that's where you get the suave, well-dressed, the tailored suit, the stereotypical Bond that we kind of knew. What's interesting about Dr. No, I mean, we're not going to go so much into, maybe the every story in gritty detail. Sean Connery was in six of the first seven James Bond films. Something I found interesting is that six films were released between 1962 and 1969. That was that was practically one a year as popularity kind of skyrocketed.
And it wore him down.
Yeah, it did. It did. It wore him down. And, well, what's funny is that basically what I learned from watching the behind the scenes of Dr. No is that they said as they were closing production, they knew they were going to have something that was pretty special. They basically used the same crew because Terrence Young is the director again. Of course, they've got James Bond, Sean Connery available because he was still kind of a no-name at that time, not a very popular actor or well-known, I should say. And they almost had the same crew. They basically went right into the production of From Russia with Love.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew that was the second book. They knew they were happy with what they were seeing on the dailies and everything that was coming in from the first film, Dr. No. And of course, Dr. No, it cost a little over $1 million. It ends up grossing nearly $60 million. Mm-hmm. From Russia with Love as a $2 million budget, that grosses about $79 million. And by the time you get to Goldfinger, $3 million budget, it grosses over $125 million. Mm-hmm. You've got a blockbuster on your hands.
Absolutely. And that's the spy movies of the 60s just completely blew up. Connery, right before Dr. No premiered, Connery actually had a small part, but he had several lines in an Oscar-winning film, not for Best Picture. I believe it was nominated. The Longest Day came out month before Dr. No, and Connery plays a private storming the beaches on D-Day in The Longest Day. It has several speaking lines in there. So you kind of went and saw him in The Longest Day, and then what do you know? He is James Bond.
And all
Bond.
Of a sudden he's James Bond, yeah.
And no longer is he playing minor speaking roles. He becomes an international icon.
Yes, he did. And Dr. No is, it holds up pretty well when people, I think, put their list together as like their favorite James Bond films. It's in the mix, but it is, I wouldn't say it was one of my favorite like rewatchable ones. Obviously we get Spectre. Mm-hmm. They're finally, right there at the beginning, they're introduced as the criminal organization, the terrorist organization, whatever you want to call it, that's going to stick around for a while.
Mm-hmm. And that took the place of a real Russian organization that Fleming was influenced called SMERSH.
SMERSH. SMERSH.
SMERSH.
That's right, SMERSH.
SMERSH came in and Spectre kind of takes over that. Although SMERSH is mentioned in From Russia with Love, it's supposed to be former SMERSH agents that have kind of joined Spectre that are kind of working out the, but it was adapted. It wasn't the exact same in real life. Fleming adapts it in the books, but it is based on real Russian groups.
Yeah, yeah. I think the most exotic and interesting thing about Dr. No is the location of Jamaica. And of course you've got Ursula Andress, that's her name, as Honey Rider, which is, let's face it, she's the first Bond girl in what would become, kind of another element of the James Bond films is, the Bond girls. And she was a good choice for that first one, because they really, what you're getting is that that these beautiful women are going to be scattered throughout all the rest of his films. And of course, she is somebody that, James Bond always hooks up with a woman. And what I mean by hook up, I don't mean in that way specifically, but there's always a connection between him and a girl that's
they're
in the
usually
plot.
Working together.
Yeah, working together. That's what I'm talking about. And as far as the CIA connection, we always have that character of Felix.
Mm-hmm. Felix Leiter, yeah.
Yeah, Leiter, who was played by Jack Lord, in which he would go on to be, was that Hawaii Five-0, I believe, Jack Lord was in. The series Hawaii Five-0, the original one. So, we do get some recognizable faces as far as like Bernard Lee as M that you mentioned. He's going to play that over and over again. We do get Q, but we don't get the Q that we're going to know. Mm-hmm. That is going to be Russia with Love. From Russia with Love is where we get Desmond Llewellyn, who's going to play it for 36 years.
Yeah, which I loved his parts when he got older, especially in the Pierce Brosnan ones. He's fantastic in those.
In fact, his last one was The World Is Not Enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like we mentioned, it is one of JFK's favorite books. From Russia with Love, what I remember about that film distinctly is the tightness of some of the fight scenes, and especially in the train.
The train, iconic. Bond has a train train sequences all the time.
And as a kid, being a fan of Jaws and Quint from Jaws, Robert Shaw, of course, plays the villain, one of the villains in From Russia with Love. And so for me, obviously he played that role before he was in Jaws, but growing up on Jaws and then turning around later on and watching, rewatching, and discovering the old James Bond films, that's something kind of stuck out to me as well, is Robert Shaw in that role. Anything else on Dr. No? I mean, like I said, we haven't really gone into, you know, the ins and outs of each plot. I thought we would just talk a little bit about each film. But
it's a solid film. It holds up. You know, I went and rewatched it a couple weeks ago when we were talking about setting this time up, just to get reintroduced to the character. And it's one that I hadn't rewatched in a long time.
I haven't. I think I watched it probably sometime last year. I have recently started rewatching some of the Bond films just out of interest, because let's face it, I just find the 1960s fascinating, not only because of the time period of the Cold War. You know, we're both history teachers, but I really like the look, the style of those films. You know, we kind of joked, we might as well mention this. We did joke a little bit earlier today. We were talking about how some millennials, and I guess you're into that, you're kind of in that mold, but millennials have started watching some of these older Bond films and have been a little disturbed by, you know, some of the aspects of, you've got like American actors that are somewhat playing like Asian actors. You've got James Bond not exactly treating women the way that is acceptable in 2018. You know, it's almost like a Mad Men kind of mentality from that show. I don't know. Any comments on that? I feel like it's a product of the time.
Film is a product of the time. So you look at the way society views certain things at certain times, and it always shows up in film. And that's, you know, that's the way it always has. I mean, we've talked about that. We've talked about that in other podcasts. Talked about the 80s, you know, the robots show up in Rocky. And it's just what's going on at the time and the way society views things or people at the time, and always shows up in film.
And I think, you know, you could argue that, you know, like the Bond women are nothing but objectifying women, but that's the role that they play in those films. I'm not trying to excuse anything that some people may look and go, you know, why, it's not exactly the way it should have been, but it is the product of the time and it is what it is. And I think James Bond, actually, some of the films actually have strong women roles in them as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the character he's playing. It's the times. Whether you like it or not, I got to say, I'm intrigued with the 60s and that time period. And to me, I just like the look of those films. We did mention From Russia with Love. That is a film that I do like to show, by the way, in History Through Film from time to time, because it is truly about, well, From Russia with Love. It has something to do with, of course, Spectre, but you do get that KGB feel to it. You do get that Russia versus the United States kind of Cold War feel. So it's an interesting, plot, especially with the... with the decoding machine,
the Lecter.
Yes, the Lecter. There you go. And because we always talked about espionage and double agents and secret codes and secret papers and this, that, and the other. And this really kind of fits in when we talk about that in my class. And so it's another great plot.
Actually, Spectre's pitting the British and Soviets against each other. They're almost acting independently, just to try to raise the tensions, because Spectre wants world domination. Of course, if the Russians and the British, two world powers, are playing off against each other, then chaos will ensue and Spectre can come in and take over.
Absolutely. And, you know, please, if you're listening to this right now and you haven't seen the James Bond movies, obviously we're not going to get into too many spoilers, because there are like 25 James Bond films. There's not really too much to spoil. They all start kind of running together if you start thinking about which ones you've seen or haven't seen. But try to watch them from the beginning, from Dr. No to Russia with Love to Goldfinger. They're fun to watch in order in that way as well. And that kind of brings us to what some consider the best.
Stop. Look. He's gunning for trouble. 007. It spells Bond.
Shocking.
He's the idol of every woman.
Who are you?
Bond. James Bond.
envy of every man, the nemesis of the treacherous Mr. Goldfinger.
I have Casino Royale and Goldfinger tied as the my two favorite. I think Goldfinger is the best of the classics, and I refer to the classics as the Moore and Connery years, and the new ages from Dalton to Pierce Brosnan to Daniel Craig. I think Goldfinger's the best of Connery. I think it's the best of the classic ones, and depending on what day you ask me, I think it might be the best of the Bond films.
Yeah, there's not a lot of people to disagree with that, especially when you see polls or you see, you know, the best of lists that come out. Every time they have a James Bond film, a new one comes out, they always redo that James Bond list. And Goldfinger, if not the number one, is at least in the top three. And it was the third film. So here's an instance where a third film is actually considered better than the first two originals. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to call these sequels, although some of the stories do kind of tie in with each other.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, but this, like I mentioned earlier, this kind of brought it up to blockbuster status, considered one of the best. And really, it's considered like the template for the rest of the series.
Yeah, there's everything in it. I mean, there's the atomic plot, you know, the world domination type thing, and Goldfinger's going to steal, you know, the wealth at Fort Knox. There's the iconic characters because you have Oddjob in that film. Yep. With the flying hat that's able to decapitate statues.
Yes.
Which I'm pretty sure they busted on MythBusters. I remember an episode of that.
How heavy does that hat have to be that he's tossing?
I know.
Jeez, that's a. I mean, but you know, that's either here or there. Yeah, and. You know, of course, it's got one of the most classic lines in the James Bond series, which is the, and I'll play the clip. Ready, go.
I think you've made your point, Goldfinger. Thank you for the demonstration. Choose your next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond. It may be your last. Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Expect me to talk? No, I expect you to die. And just the, and of course, the iconic, girl who is her name again, I can't even think about it.
Who are you?
My name is Pussy Galore.
Isn't it customary to grant the condemned man his last request?
You've asked for this.
Come and purr over Anna Blackman as Pussy Galore. The female who is all feline.
It's Pussy Galore, isn't it? Yes, it is. It's one of the best. Of course, you get the classic James Bond names that, of course, have those double innuendos. There we go. Double meanings. But that is one of the most iconic shots in a James Bond film, is her laid out on that bed just completely gold. Painted gold, which I think didn't MythBusters also.
I think MythBusters did do a Bond one, and that wasn't that character.
That's right.
Miss Galore was working with Goldfinger until she joined Bond's side at the end. That was you know, that was a different. That was why I'm glad. I think her first name was Jill.
Yes,
And she was working with Goldfinger. Obviously, her and Bond. Bond started associating with her, and then Goldfinger responds by covering.
Yes,
her
Jill. Yeah.
That's right. Gold.
She was kind of a minor character at that time in the film, because it doesn't happen at the beginning.
Yeah, it happens in the beginning once Bond goes over to the States.
That's right.
Okay. You know, one thing we forgot to mention.
Oh yeah, bring it up.
Is the cars.
Oh, yeah, the cars.
And, of course, the car is an Aston Martin.
Yes.
And specifically, the Aston Martin DB5 was probably the most iconic of them. You know, the cars are incredibly... It appeared in Goldfinger.
That was its first appearance,
The DB5 appeared in Goldfinger.
Yes.
And... again, you have the classic James Bond in a car.
Yeah.
And it's huge in the series. Bond and cars are huge. The latest film, Spectre, has a fantastic car chase through Rome, I believe, is the city that it was in. I was probably, I think most people say it's probably the best car sequence of the entire franchise. It's phenomenally shot. But yeah, the Aston Martin DB5 is the Bond car that is well known, and of course Q and everybody else always tricks out the DB5 to do what it needs to do to get Bond out of trouble.
And the gadgets, I mean, like I said, we mentioned the gadgets. You know, one thing about just to mention with the newer James Bonds is that they're not quite to that. They're not really using the gadgets. I guess you could say that perhaps they work in the Connery era, because again, this is an era where we are in the midst of the Cold War. There's new technology that's appearing. You know, the fact that in the book they use like a saw, I think, to almost kill James Bond, but in Goldfinger he uses a laser. Mm-hmm. Well, a laser existed by the time that they made Goldfinger, but not when he wrote the book. So the point is that the gadgets in these older films, I think, play a crucial role, because that's a reflection of what's going on at the time in the Cold War, where new technology and these, you know, up and coming gadgets that you would just see. Well, let's face it. I mean, in Thunderball, for instance, you've got that opening scene where he gets the jetpack.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Exactly. And what were people, you know, ranting and raving about back in the day? Well, this jetpack was, you know, a man can fly. It was new technology that you would see. You could just Google or YouTube, you know, old 60s, 70s jetpack videos, and you see guys that are trying out. You know, the astronauts, you know, played around with training and so forth. So, yeah, you know, the gadgets, I think, fit the older James Bond films really well, because there's a kind of a place for them.
What's the more famous jetpack, the James Bond jetpack or the Boba Fett jetpack?
Well, James Bond, you know, I think he flew it a little better than Boba Fett, if you recall the Sarlacc pit tumble that he took after Han hits that with a staff. So I would have to say that James Bond is going to win the jetpack flying award over Boba Fett. But that is a good question. We should put that up to a poll or something. You know, again, I know we're kind of blending into some different films here, but Thunderball would be his next one after Goldfinger.
Look up. Look out! Here comes the biggest Bond of all. Thunderball.
You know, and that's one that has a little bit of history because of the legal problems that it got into.
Yeah.
With the producers, you know, Harry Saltzman and Albert R. Broccoli got into a kind of a legal situation with Kevin McClory, who has a writing credit and believed that he had come up with the story. And that would follow them all the way through. Well, it was, you know, almost all the way up until Never Say Never Again, which is almost a remake of Thunderball.
It's basically a remake of Thunderball, starring a very aging Sean Connery.
Yes, because they ended up giving, I believe, this Kevin McClory a producing credit on Thunderball, and then of course they give him, I think, full credit when it comes into Never Say Never Again, where James Bond is, and Roger Moore is like 52 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But it still works, because they kind of changed it to where they bring, I think, 007 out of retirement or something at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's been so long since I've actually seen that one.
That's my least favorite Connery appearance as Bond.
Well, you know who directed that by chance? Irvin Kershner, the director of Empire Strikes Back.
Hmm.
So the Empire Strikes Back gave him, you know, that was such a success. And of course, considered the best Star Wars film, if not one of the best or the best. They snagged Irvin Kershner because of the success of The Empire Strikes Back. So Thunderball, and what's great about Thunderball, you know, again, it's a very, very solid James Bond film. May not be the best on everyone's mm-hmm. list. I like the underwater sequences.
Those are kind of the iconic part of the underwater sequence with the spear gun fights. Those were really neat. And obviously the main plot of it is, you know, two nuclear bombs are held essentially for ransom.
Yeah.
Which is perfect Cold War paranoia.
Perfect Cold War. I mean, exactly. Fits right in there. In fact, Thunderball is one that we've watched before as well, because anytime you can combine, you know, the Cold War fears and nuclear war fears, and you throw it in with a spy film, you know, that's kind of a perfect picture of this is what audiences are drawn to. This is a reflection of what's going on in the real world. So, of course, you know, plots like Thunderball fit right in.
And at that point, Bond was an absolute superstar, and Sean Connery was an absolute superstar. And there's actually a famous Life magazine cover of Sean Connery in his ripped wetsuit, chest hair coming out.
Oh, yeah.
As he's on the cover of it, it was actually the January 7th, 1966 edition. And the reason I know this is because I was in college and we were walking in some antique store or something. And they had the cover of it. And my wife's favorite James Bond is Sean Connery.
Yes.
So naturally we had to, in her words, he is the James Bond. So obviously we had to get the Life cover of James Bond, the Thunderball one. But yeah, it's one of the entertaining rewatchable ones, simply for the underwater sequences. And
yeah,
the storyline's good. But you know, it breaks from the norm. I think it was a good shift of pace for the franchise.
You got to do something different. Yeah, you can't just be doing the same thing. So underwater, and you know, that is where it you know, where you just got to change locations, mm-hmm. and it works. One that I enjoy as well is the next one, You Only Live Twice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anything else on Thunderball or any of the ones that we just discussed? I mean, as we move through these, just interrupt me. And
yeah, well, it's important to remember that Bond's a superstar right now.
Yes.
I mean, absolutely. Yep. The world's captivated by it, and they can basically do whatever they want at this point.
You're right. And like when I was talking about the budgets doubling, the budgets almost keep doubling, but even the profits keep doubling, it seems like. So these movies are mega popular, and they are mega profitable as well. And with You Only Live Twice, the Cold War is heating up, mm-hmm. as we like to say. In this one, working for the government of an unnamed Asian power, Blofeld. Blofeld's back. And by the way, we haven't really mentioned Blofeld, but he's kind of synonymous with Spectre. And he's going to be played by several different actors, but also is going to be kind of reignited in, of course, 2015's Spectre as well. So... they kidnap some manned spacecrafts belonging to the Soviets and the United States. So now we're getting the space race element into the films as well.
Mm-hmm.
We've had nuclear war. We've had espionage. We have all these, like a decryptor machine kind of thing, the Lector. And now we're getting into spacecraft and space flight and a little bit of the space race mm-hmm. element of the
Late
Cold War.
'60s. We're trying to make it to the moon.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's all reflecting what society is doing.
Yep. And so this was obviously the fifth James Bond film, influenced again by the Cold War, like we've been talking about. Something else that's interesting is this is one of the main inspirations for the Austin Powers movies. And I do like to take a moment just to talk about those because obviously, like my students, they know the Austin Power films. Austin Power films are hilarious, and they are well done. And, of course, they're a parody of the James Bond films. But you've got Dr. Evil from Austin Powers. Of course, is supposed to be like the Bond supervillain, Blofeld. And you got Frau Frobisher, who is the female evil person in Austin Powers, who is supposed to be like Rosa Klebb from Russia with Love. You've got Dr. Evil's volcano base. Well, in You Only Live Twice, Spectre has a volcano base.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Odd Job, you mentioned from Goldfinger, we get Random Task in Austin Powers, which, and other characters as well. There's many, many, I could go on and on with all the references, but those are ones that obviously stand out I just like to make that connection when I, you know, if I'm teaching some of these films in history through film, because the kids can, students can relate to it that way as well.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, obviously Bond is going to trigger spoofs and, you know, obviously, you know, even if you think of the modern 2000s, another popular British actor, Rowan Atkinson, came out with the Johnny English
series. Yes, Johnny English.
And which is just, it's him trying to act like Bond, essentially.
Well, and the Kingsmen. I mean, the Kingsmen are nothing more than not really comedies, but a twist on James Bond with
something about British special intelligence.
Yes,
that just it catches on. It really does.
Yep. Well, after You Only Live Twice, we've got Connery retiring from the role.
He was worn out.
He was worn out.
Too many movies in a short time. Very similar to what Daniel Craig went through.
Yes.
If you remember Craig talking about...
He said he was done.
Yeah, he said he was done. But much like Connery, every man has his price.
Yes.
And the studios, I'm sure, showed up to Daniel Craig's house and emptied out a truck of money and said, we'd like you to do it one more time.
They did. So 1971, we get Diamonds Are Forever, which, of course, is Connery's return to the role and his final
until his final Bond produced by Eon. And Eon, of course, stands for Everything or Nothing Productions.
Yes, Everything or Nothing. That is interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. That is what that stands for. And, of course, Never Say Never Again, 1983, was a what's considered canon,
if you will,
you know, James Bond, because it is a remake of Thunderball. But what I find interesting about Diamonds Are Forever is this is where, after George Lazenby declines, he makes On Your Majesty's Secret Service. He declines under the advice of his agent, so the story goes, to play another James Bond. Producers first wanted to go more of an Americanized James Bond. I'm not sure if you knew this or not, but... they were looking at, where do we go from here? We don't have Sean Connery. What if we Americanize the film or the franchise, the character? Mm-hmm. So believe it or not, they run into an actor who's over in London for several reasons and have a conversation with him. Unfortunately, they have some talks, but this actor's not able to get out of his contract as Batman. Adam West, of all people, was in the back of their mind for having that Americanized James Bond.
Grab but the Spectre repellent.
Yes. Grab the anti-bald guy, bad guy repellent. But think about it for a minute. Picture Adam West as an American James Bond. I don't know. I'm thinking it might work. I mean, he was a good actor, but... he's not James Bond,
No.
But if you're going to go an American spy route, I don't think that's such a bad choice.
No, because, you know, if you look back at his Batman time, he was Bruce Wayne, who was a socialite. He was dressed up. He was had the smoothness, which...
he was American James Bond as
which
Batman.
Which is Bond,
exactly. So check this out. They actually cast the actor John Gavin. And John Gavin, you guys aren't going to probably recognize the name, but if you've seen Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, he played Sam, who was the boyfriend of Vivian Leigh's character in Psycho. Janet Leigh's character.
Gone with the Wind.
Yes, no, not Vivian Leigh. Jeez. We played Janet Leigh's character, Marion. Thank you. Oh my gosh, it just came back to me. So John Gavin, who played Sam, he was cast. But then, of course, they decide that they want to get Sean Connery. They back the truck up with $1.25 million.
Record
at that time. Of course, they pay John Gavin his salary and say thank you, but no thank you. And they, and Connery says in an interview that he donated all that money to the Scottish International Education Trust. It's basically for artists that decide to stay in Scotland. Hmm. Painters, writers, poets, whatever.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so he actually donated that fee there. And we pick up right where on Her Majesty's Secret Service ends, which, by the way, that movie just ends so kind of bleak. Because his wife gets killed.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, you know, it's almost like a cliffhanger.
Yeah, it's...
But it's not a bad film. It's just different.
It's not. It is different. And it's probably worth noting a few things. The opening scene where Bond is fighting on the beach.
Yes.
And the girl gets away. And George Lazenby's character stares right into the camera and said, "Well, that didn't happen to the other guy."
That's great. I will say that over the years, since, you know, we should be talking about George Lazenby's, you know, performance, over the years has gained more and more acceptance. Mm-hmm. More people have realized that it's actually a better film than what it first got credit for. And in fact, when these lists come out year after year, more and more people are putting it on the top of their list.
Well, how can you? And it's a tough task replacing Sean Connery.
But it holds up, and just little things like that you talked about, that you know, that scene on the beach and that line about it didn't happen to the other guy is true. What's great about Diamonds Are Forever is that the opening sequence is Bond getting revenge for the death of his wife, which, you know, another character had played James Bond right at the end of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Yeah. So Sean Connery fits right back in. Also, what's interesting is, I guess in the book Diamonds Are Forever, the villain is actually Goldfinger's twin brother.
I haven't read that one.
Yeah, and they dropped that idea when they got to the movie. The things that changed during production. But one character that does stand out to me is the character of Willard White. It's the guy in Diamonds Are Forever who's locked away, who's been kind of held captive. Mm-hmm. That's Jimmy Dean.
Yes.
And that is the Sausage
King. Sausage Maker, yeah.
The Sausage King, Jimmy Dean. Not only a Grand Ole Opry star, but yes, he was the Jimmy Deans that we like to fry up on Saturday mornings, or at least I do. And he's essentially Howard Hughes. That's who he is. Now, what's funny is that Jimmy Dean was playing at the Desert End in Vegas. He had like a reoccurring stint there. Mm-hmm. Howard Hughes owns the Desert End. Howard Hughes, in fact, owns several casinos in Las Vegas. And Jimmy Dean, in a recollection on an interview, basically said, "I'm playing my boss in this film." He's like, you know, but Howard Hughes was a James Bond fan. In fact, mm-hmm. they said that at that time they sent him a print of every film for him to own, just to kind of soften him up a bit. But nothing really ever came of that, other than the fact that the producers, of course, Albert R. Broccoli, they knew connections in Las Vegas, because Diamonds Are Forever does take place heavily in Las Vegas. Yeah. So there was a lot of shutting down the sets or shutting down downtown Las Vegas so they could film some scenes like Five Nights for a Car Chase and things like that. So, and I will say there is an interesting odd assassin couple in, do you remember Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd? These are the two guys that are the kind of the comic relief, and they are the assassins. They're almost like Tweedledee and Tweedledum or something from like Alice in Wonderland. They talk to each other in weird ways. They're pretty brutal in the film. But what's interesting about them is their questionable relationship, at least for that time, because they are in a another interview, the two actors that played them, they basically said, "Yeah, we were gay characters in that film." It's strongly implied in the film that the two are lovers. They're seen holding hands in one scene. Mr. Wint also has a habit of putting on women's perfume. And at one point, Mr. Kidd remarks that Tiffany Case, one of the, you know, characters, is attractive for a lady. And he gets a strange look from the other guy. So I only bring that up because in the film, they are a big part of the plot. And they are interesting characters, and they're funny, and they're weird, and they're kind of... But at the time... This is still 1971? Mm-hmm. It's a very bold move to have characters like that in a James Bond film from a very early 1970s. You would think that would be very divisive, but no one really even talks about it.
There was when they were supposed to basically kill Bond, it does lead to one of the famous escape scenes. The two of them are there, and Bond escapes the cremation chamber.
Yes.
Which is one of the iconic scenes from that film.
Yeah.
But, you know, everyone thought Connery was done after that. He thought, well, that's got to be it.
Yes.
Because he signed on for one more. In my mind, I like to think Connery was done. simply for the fact that I'm not a huge Never Say Never Again fan, yeah. Because it just kind of, you have to bring Connery back. You're not, it's not produced by Eon.
No.
So they've got to do something to sell it. Because if they would have gone with a no-name actor or someone that had never played Bond before, because you know it's going to be a standalone film.
Yeah.
They weren't going to go back and probably do another one. So they had to bring Connery on it. I mean, it's okay.
Well, and I think one reason it was done is because they had the rights to that specific story.
Screw it with.
So they could just remake Thunderball.
Sure.
And not have to worry about copyright infringement or stepping on toes of other books.
Yeah.
So to me, it was a commercial success. It mm-hmm. was a somewhat critical success.
Sure, yeah, it sold.
People wanted to see.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, who wouldn't, you know, I was only like
Sean Connery's back? Yeah. Of course we're going to go yeah. see it.
I mean, if it was today and it would have worked, I would have been all over that as well. But, yeah, I do vaguely remember it and I remember it being a big deal. But, yeah, I mean, it is what it is. Bring him back and... And of course, the audience followed.
Mm-hmm.
But James Bond, Sean Connery, the one that we love and most people will agree is James Bond. His tenure came to an end. And then it was passed on, of course, to Roger Moore. And that was my James Bond growing mm-hmm. up. And those are another good set of films that we will hopefully talk about in a future day.
Different themes, different style.
70s-ish, very, you know.
A lot more campy, yeah, kind of.
Campy, definitely. And mm-hmm. and you'll even see in the James and the Sean Connerys, as they kind of progress, some people will criticize, like, Thunderball getting a little campy and, you know, Diamonds Are Forever, a little campy, you know, especially the volcano
sure.
island and all this, you know.
But they're cyclical. The Bonds are cyclical in the sense that you kind of get a little grittier in the Timothy Dalton ones.
Yes.
And then you get Pierce Brosnan, and there's tons of gadgets and everything that goes along with that. And then Daniel Craig has been hard-nosed, very gritty.
Yes.
And especially in these last two, his gadgets aren't really like what you would think of as spy gadgets.
No, they're not.
Have nearly the fancy exploding briefcases and
yes.
everything else from the Bond time.
But they're good. They're all good. I mean, I'm a big of a fan as anybody else and cannot wait for the next one. But until then, any last thoughts? Anything that you want to add? Anything that you felt like we left out? Or
I mean, I do think Connery is the iconic Bond. Yep. Obviously, has the benefit of going first.
Set the bar.
But in terms of catching up with him, you know, I was at a different position because I got to go back and watch all of them. Like, I didn't start with one actor.
Yeah.
Which kind of gives me a little bit different perspective because I didn't necessarily grow up with a Bond because I didn't see any until I was 18 or 19 years old.
And you don't have to. That's the beauty about James
fantastic.
Bond films.
Yeah.
You can, you know, yeah, some of them are connected. I would say that the newer James Bonds, mm-hmm. there is almost a trilogy there, but you don't really have, you just pick them up and go. I would recommend if you're listening to us right now and you haven't seen very many James Bonds, start at the beginning, like we said.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Go through, watch the Connerys, maybe read more about them, learn a little bit, appreciate them, then move on into the Roger Moores and so forth. So,
great films. I love the Connery films.
Yep.
Looking forward to possibly talking some more Bond films in
yes,
the future.
Yes, and we will do that. So we will move into a part two of James Bond later on with Roger Moore. And we'll certainly discuss those as well. Now, again, thank you for joining us. We're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. This is a little shorter than most of them, and that'll be good for our listeners as well. But again, if you want to reach out, you know where to find us on History Through Film on Twitter. You can reach us there. And thank you for listening. Make sure you follow us on iTunes and Podomatic. And please subscribe and rate us and all that good stuff. And yeah, until next time, Alex, thank you for joining me again.
Always glad to be here.
Yep, and we do know that we've got some future episodes coming up. We're going to do one on sequels, and that'll be fun. We've got some on Tarantino films. That'll be fun as well. So we've got a whole hodgepodge of different topics. So until then, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time.